Now, is it at that point, it wouldn't be, you know, on the 26th of April, 1958, that these planes are going to become obsolete, but I mean, in this time area, when they are faced with replacement, is it at that point that the new role is decided upon? And if not, at what point does the concept of the new role come into play?
Well,
or where does it originate? Where is
NATO was, of course, had lost interest, really, in the Air Superiority Day fighter. It felt that it would not be effective in the time available because of the closeness of the respective armies and the small area of Europe. Consequently, that role was essentially washed out. They went over to a concept where the air forces of NATO would be used primarily, though they didn't rule out occasional use of day fighters, but primarily as strike, as they called it, which was the nuclear attack role, and what is now called attack, which is the close support, often called the close support role of land forces. And it really left Canada with no other role but the strike one, unless Canada was prepared to divide the air division and assign it, keep it simply as an administrative entity and assign the wings to other foreign, if you like, air forces like the French Tactical Air Command and perhaps the American, to be tasked by them in support of their respective armies in the attack role. This was the nub of the problem, I think, and at that time, of course, and the airmen were not particularly upset by the idea of the nuclear role. The aircraft did have the capability of carrying out the attack role with conventional weapons, although at the time, I don't believe, I have to rely on memory here, that we had really ordered any of the weapons. In fact, I know we hadn't any of the weapons. I think we had the capability of doing it. The airplane still retains a day fighter capability if the radar is adjusted to be optimum in that mode as opposed to the ground map reading mode that's required for ground attack, for the strike role. So I think that the nuclear role in the airplane were really... although it had, the nuclear weapon part had not been approved by the government at that time, I believe that the government was aware it was the major role for the aircraft. Mr. Harkness says it did have other capability, which in the ensuing arguments tended to be played down.
Mm-hmm.
But organizationally, of course, if you used it in the other capability, primarily, you brought up this whole question again of Canadian Operational Command. And
yeah. But even at that...
One is left always with the feeling, let me put it this way, Dr. Roy, that the Canadian government always wanted to exercise a power veto over what the Canadians did. I remember back earlier when we had the F-86s, initially we flew them armed, guns hot. And then External Affairs became most concerned about the legality of having rules of engagement operative in peacetime in Europe, when we did not have a right of a real right to be in Europe, unlike the British, who were occupation force and so on. And so we were told we were not to fly hot to trot, and since you simply load the guns on an F-86 by pressing the trigger and pneumatic system brings the breech bolts back, we actually had to put the T-pieces, which we use for clearing the guns, into the breech bolts to ensure that the guns couldn't be loaded by the pilot. And we flew like that for a long time. Finally, and subsequently, I think the NATO rules of engagement, while they were, in fact, accepted by Canada, and then we were able to go back and be like everybody else. But we were considered the only country in NATO in 52 and 53 and 54 who had not a right to be in Europe in the sense that grew out of the Second World War.
Yeah.
We weren't an occupying power.
The question comes up, of course, again with these nuclear weapons, or at least not with the nuclear weapons, directly, indirectly, and that is the extent to which, quote, the government, quote, realized that when you got the new type of aircraft, they realized the primary role for this would be on a nuclear strike role. Now, evidently, Perks realized this quite well, and to what extent either he or the chief of the air staff brought this to the attention of the politicians is apparently quite something still up in the air. You know, you'll get arguments.
Well, I don't think you can disassociate in your mind the 104 and the Bomark. They were both designed, at least in the G configuration, because we adopted the 104, they were both designed to carry the nuclear warhead. Now, the B version Bomark, as you were well aware, there was never an HE warhead designed for it. The B Bomark is so different from the A that they, except in external appearance, that they might well have given it quite a different designation. It's an entirely different, really in a different weapon system, or substantially different.
Mm-hmm.
But they never did design it with for any HE warhead. And in the case of the Bomark, it was, in this particular case, as you know, the Americans, or may not know, the Americans bought and provided and retained title to the Bomarks.
Yeah.
Now, it was clear that if we were not going to put nuclear warheads in, the Americans were not going to spend all the money necessary to design HE,
mm-hmm.
and therefore would have withdrawn them.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about that. So I feel convinced in my own mind that the government had accepted the idea of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And due to influences in the cabinet, ascendancies in the cabinet, and I suspect Mr. Howard Green.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
The government shifted, because governments do shift without changing, because of weight shift in the cabinet. Now, I think in all cases, the ministers of national defense, General Perks and Mr. Harkness, were fully aware of the that we had essentially, by the first act, agreed to nuclear weapons, even if we hadn't done so formally. And the issue seemed to revolve around the morality of the weapon.
Yeah.
And it became clearer as the debate went on, I think, that if there were degrees of immorality in having anything to do with nuclear weapons, it was clearly, in some people's minds, more immoral to have them in a strike role than it was to have them in a role where you would only use them if nuclear-loaded bombers entered your country, i.e. the role of the Bomark and the Voodoo, the 101.
Mm-hmm.
And hence the decision, ultimately given effect to essentially disarm the air division by taking out its primary weapon, and because the 104 remains a very poor weapon carrier, because it's very little airplane, a very poor weapon carrier in relation to, say, the F-4. It'll only carry something like 4,000 pounds of conventional ordnance, as opposed to about 12,000. And when you're talking about iron bombs, 12,000 versus 4 means something.
Yeah.
In terms of nuclear weapons, the weight is not that important, and it remained an excellent nuclear carrier. Because certainly if you were going to buy an aircraft to carry out the tactical bomber role, which I spoke of earlier, and in the terms of using conventional or so-called conventional weapons, HE and the like, you wouldn't go the 104 route. You'd go the F-4. Which is another reason that certain airmen always felt it was a better choice, because it was more flexible. It could carry a ton of iron if it was necessary. In fact, six tons, eh?
Well, what?
The mistake was, having decided if we're going to back off a nuclear role, It really shouldn't have been the 104. But we'd already started production on the 104 by then. I think we had, I would concede that, I suggest that we changed our minds.
Yeah.
We felt that that was a decision. Perhaps so, based on my own experience in Ottawa, perhaps it was thought of this way, that this is a decision we can make when we come to it. This is the usual way in politics and in Ottawa. That town is absolutely resolved for irresolution. If they can put it off, yeah, they'll put it off. And I think that they probably said, well, we'll reach, cross that bridge when we come to it. Mm-hmm. Not fully realizing, perhaps, that in committing themselves to the 104, they were essentially throwing away $400 million if they didn't go the rest of the way to the nuclear weapon, because it was the wrong airplane if it didn't carry it.
Well, this is one thing that I was going to ask you. You know, one mentions, or you've been mentioned, or Harkins made mention of other capabilities. and certainly, as you suggested, they were limited capabilities. But of what use would they have been? Can you give me some indication? If you didn't have the nuclear weapon, what role could they have played?
Well, they could have carried out, as they continued to do very successfully, the reconnaissance role, which was a very important role, and one that NATO regards as the highest importance and requires a very high degree of skill and intelligence, for that matter, on the part of the pilots. And as you know, the RCAF and the Canadian Force today is a very, very professional outfit. But it wouldn't have warranted eight squadrons. So there had to be something else for this size of contribution.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're going to do the strike role, well, whereas the 104 can do it, the attack role, rather, and is now configured to do it, it means that you have to essentially program three 104s for every F-4 you would use, because of the weight difference. Because in dealing with conventional ordnance, you're dealing with a question of weight. The more weapons, the more conventional weapons, the bigger ones, the better they are. And as you know, 4,000 pounds is not a hell of a lot in comparison to World War One capability. Memory serves me correctly, the Typhoon would lift close to that. Three, I'm not sure, but something like that.
So in other words,
I think they really, the ministers concerned, got themselves into a spot where I think that they were fully aware of the implications. The actual decision had not then been taken, was put off by the government, and then when it came time for it, they no longer wanted to do it, and they were in a difficult position of having gotten too far down the road.
Yeah.
With the Bomarc, had they thrown the Bomarc out at the last minute, they would have been out of pocket something in the order for the two Bomarc bases, 25, 26 million.
Yeah.
104 was a very different story.
Yeah. What did 104 cost, by the way? I could find
I think about $2 million apiece at that particular point in time. I think we produced about 200 104s for about $400 million.
Yeah.
As you're aware, it's pretty hard to nail down the price of an airplane, because it depends how much you throw into it. But
yeah.
I think it was advertised at a little over $1 million at the time, $1 million or $1.5 million, something like that. But it depends what arguments you're trying to make. You know, if you don't want to buy the Arrow, you can say it costs $9.5 million. If you want to buy the Arrow, you say it costs about $4.5 million or $5 million.
Yeah. There's some arguments that were used against the whole idea of the air division. I don't have them all right in my hot little paws, but there's one here, and we'll have to make this the last question, but I do hope I can have you again on this. and I'm not sure where I got this from, but the note reads roughly, RCF squadrons with tactical nuclear bombs were based on two airfields within range of the Russians' ICBM. If the Russians attacked, wouldn't they blast the bases? And if not, would the RCF be useful only in a first strike role? If the USSR launched an all-out attack with the ICBMs, not the ICBMs, but the IBMs.
IRBMs.
Yeah, intermediate range. The RCF would be written off. Thus, is not the role illogical? We touched on that a bit.
Yes, well, that was often said, although you must remember that we had aircraft at high degree of readiness on the quick reaction alert, which on release from shape could have launched, it was believed, at least from some of the airfields before the strikes hit, so that you would have some survival capability. But if it was without any warning whatsoever, there's no doubt that I just can't believe the Soviet would not have targeted so efficient a force. They couldn't afford not to.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned earlier, the theory or thought behind that is that this forced them to use nuclear weapons if they were going to attack in Europe. One of the fears in Europe, and that led, of course, even to rather less than completely logical concepts about the peripheral attacks and the ACE force and the like, has been the attacking by the Soviet Union without using nuclear weapons, but sort of infiltrating without making a clear indication that this is it, this is
yeah.
the big one.
Yeah.
And this has long bothered NATO commanders. What do you do under those circumstances? This is bearing in mind that NATO is not quite the same thing as NORAD, in the sense that the operational command of NORAD is enjoyed all the time. NATO is only enjoyed in the event of an attack, and the command structure is playing. It has to really, even for exercises, get permission of the national forces. This is not a case with NORAD, which is an in-being thing.
Yeah.
That has a much more instant response. And this is the difficulty. What happens in the event that there isn't a clear-cut decision? Most military people feel, and I think with a lot of justification, that the politicians are not as decisive as military. They have great difficulty in making up their mind. And when issues seem to be at all clouded, they seek to defer them.
Mm.
And certainly in Canada, this seems to be the practice.
Oh, brother. Yeah.
And the difficulty, I think, that they faced was how could you be sure that the Soviets didn't pull a trick like this? So that by the time we really got about, they'd already occupied half of Germany, which they could have done.
Yeah.
There's little doubt that for a long time, and probably even now, there's doubt that you could stop them east of the Rhine. There is no great natural barrier. The agreement which set the demarcation lines where they were at Yalta were most unwise from our point of view, extraordinarily wise from the Russian point of view.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it has not made Germany, which has been the battlefield of Europe for centuries, highly defensible. The first real defensive bulwark was the Rhine. And as you know, it's not just the fact of the river, it's also the fact of the terrain that makes the Rhine what it is. It's only in the northern part of the Rhine where you can assault reasonably easily. And even that's not so easy, as you'll remember from the first Canadian Army going the other way.
True enough.
It's all canals and everything.
Well, I think we better stop there for the present. I've hammered away at you rather long, but I do hope we can get together and battle out some of these. There are, and I don't see them right here, a large, there's quite a critical body of opinion about the role of the air division and all that, and I want to dig up some of these arguments so I can present them to you and get the counter-arguments and this, that, and the other thing.
Well, I think it's best to do it this way rather than if I knew what the questions were before, because then I'd try and, think about it and rationalize it, where it's better this way. I'm going back to what we thought at the time as best I'm able.
Right.
Which is the greatest problem, I'm sure, from a historian's point of view, is that, and I suffer from the hindsight, too. It's not easy to remember whether these were compelling factors at that particular point in time. Although what I've told you really about the role of the air division became a problem almost the moment we arrived, because there had been no substantial agreement beforehand how we would operate.
Yeah.
And in the early discussions, and what was then the nucleus of the 4th Allied Tactical Air Force, which I joined just before, for about 3 months, this question came up, and it was necessary for me, as I was only a staff officer, of course, to seek some guidance on this matter, and I could guess what our position would be from what it had been in the past, and certainly I was informed that it was to retain the force under Canadian command, that the commander of the 1st Canadian Division was certainly subordinated to the commander of the 1st Tactical Allied Air Force.
No.
And that was accepted. But the force was not to be divided below his level.
Yeah, that I can, knowing the Canadian reaction, I can imagine that too.
Yeah.
Well, lovely. Well, let's hope to God that this came out on the tape.
Well, I hope it did. And
let's see.
I personally think,
White. Yeah.